Okay, welcome to Curry Beach's temporary town hall. If we had waited a week, we could have used the new town hall, but we were pretty anxious. So, just a couple things that I wanted to talk about. Restrooms, if you have the courage. Water in the back, again, if you have the courage to fight your way back there. And of course, the exit, the only exit is the way you came in. So if we do need to do that, we're going to have to do it in a very orderly fashion. So just so I would let you know. Now, I have a question. How many are here from Carolina Beach? Okay, nice number. Are the rest from Curie Beach? Who's from Curie Beach? Okay, good. Well, I'm glad that we could share.
We've got off the island.
Okay. OTI, off the island, or over the bridge, OTB. Okay. It's our pleasure to have the opportunity, thanks to former Curie Beach Mayor Mac Montgomery, who put me in touch with these fine individuals, which I'm going to introduce, to have this session on coyotes. I know that we all have a concern about coyotes. We hear them. Occasionally we see them. And tonight will be an important thing. What should we do? What shouldn't we do? And we brought the experts. Let me tell you who the experts are. The first expert is Chris Kent. Chris is the biologist for the North Carolina Wildlife. And we have Becky Skiba, and she is the coastal education specialist from North Carolina Wildlife. And we have North Carolina Wildlife Supervisor, Evan Stanford. So we have good representation. I hope you brought your questions, but I think they're going to be pretty thorough in what they tell us to do and what not to do. I'd also like to say that we have Alan Oliver, commissioner here, and we have Joe Whitley. Where are you, Joe? Joe Whitley, another commissioner from Curie Beach. So, with that, and Beth Chase. Beth? Okay, Beth gave up her evening. She's part of the administrative staff so that we could all enjoy this presentation tonight as well. If you have any questions, maybe I'll let you determine if you want people to ask questions as you go, save them till the end, or what would you like these fine people to do?
Yeah, let's. I'll go through a brief presentation, and if you can save your questions to the end, that way I can get through that part, so people don't start falling asleep on me, and then we'll open up for questions. But yeah,
okay, that sounds very good. Any questions on anything right now? Okay, we know where the water is. We know where the bathroom is. We know how to get out. We know how to act orderly, and you have it.
That sounds great. Chris.
Thank you. Well, Craig got me here because he told me there would probably be five or six people that were sick.
I'm just kidding, but
I'm glad to see a turnout like this. And, you know, oftentimes when we have a big turnout like this, there's a lot of people here that love wildlife. There's a lot of people here that love wildlife until it's in their yard. There's a lot of people with mixed feelings about different wildlife. I started building a presentation on all wildlife that I commonly get phone calls about in a wildlife conflict type situation, but the initial call was to bring information on coyotes. So I started taking alligator stuff out, black bear stuff out, raccoon, possum, skunk, snake, everything else, you know, that I commonly get calls about, El Chupacabra, and kind of tailored it just to coyotes. So someone did get that joke. Okay, great. My name is Chris Kent. I'm your district wildlife biologist. We have our state broken up into 9 districts, and I say we, the Wildlife Resources Commission. These are the 9 districts across the state. District 2 is right here. And so I'm your primary contact person for wildlife management related questions, wildlife conflict questions at your property, if you have wildlife damage issues, if you have a need for a type of permit related to wildlife, or say you want to create wildlife habitat at your property. You love seeing wildlife and want to bring them in. Perhaps I could assist you with a lot of that. And so I'll stick around afterwards. Make sure everybody has my contact information should you want that. But so this is my district, the 12 southeastern counties. It's hard to see, but I kind of go from Greenville, Pitt County, all the way down to New Hanover County and everything in between. It's a big area. I spend a lot of time on the road. I enjoy it. I'm in New Hanover County a lot, especially as you know the weather gets a little warmer and alligators start coming out and getting active. So
Yeah, got here.
And as I mentioned before, my name is Becky Skiba, and I'm a Southeastern Coastal Regional Education Specialist. Basically, that just means that I travel a lot to teach people about wildlife and answer questions and get people excited about, like Chris was saying, creating habitat, but also any kind of wildlife-human interactions or conflicts. And I actually am in zone or districts 4 and 2. So if you have any friends or neighbors or relatives that live in some of those other areas and they have concerns about certain species, I do a lot of presentations and things and trips to go out and see alligators and other things like that. So if any kind of a wildlife workshop, or if you see some people that are like, oh, they're having issues with coyotes or something else over there, or we would just really love to learn about this. I have my contact information and business cards up here as well, so you can get up with me about it, and we'll hopefully be able to schedule something that we can get everybody interested in.
Absolutely, and Becky's got a bigger territory than I do, so we spend a lot of time in our vehicles driving around. So, but I wanted to show you a picture of Curry Beach here, see if I can see this fancy pointer. Here we go. Ooh. I need to stand up here. I need to point it at the screen there. Let's see. First time using this. What I wanted to point out, and maybe I'm not going to be very good at this, but I'm not going to do that. You can see with your own eyes how much green is on there. Technology is not my forte. That's why I work with wildlife, all right? So the entire western side of this landmass is all green. So from a wildlife habitat standpoint, you know, that's why many of us are here. The western side's beautiful forest, swamp, marsh. The east side's beautiful ocean and beach. I mean, this area has everything typically people want, right? So there is also a lot of wildlife in our area as well, as I'm going to talk about. But Curry Beach has nature, recreation, and location, and wildlife comes with that. Let's see. So common wildlife in your area, where to begin is a good start. So I did put some of the creepy crawlies up there. A lot of folks are like, when they see stuff like that. We do have a lot of reptiles in our area, a lot of snakes. These critters right here, the copperheads, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because they're not coyotes, but when you go out at night, you know, have a flashlight. That's how most people get bit, is they accidentally step on one. But let me get to, there we go. So common mammals that we might see in our area, I'm sure you're probably familiar with most of these. The one right in the center, that's the one that this presentation is about tonight, the coyote. And, you know, they can come in different colors, sometimes totally black, sometimes what looks to be white, but maybe it's kind of a creamy yellow color. That's a really common color right there. They have 5 color phases that we see, but, you know, most common concerns that people express to me when they call me having coyote issues around their property really is just the presence. You know, they don't know much about coyotes. They're fearful of them. They're scared for their pets, for children. So just seeing them in the area often is a reason for concern. Some people ask about disease. You know, I saw one in my yard during the daytime. Does that mean it has rabies? So disease is definitely an issue. And then livestock damage. We probably don't have a lot of livestock down in this area, but maybe people have chickens, poultry. I'm not sure what your local, you know, laws and HOA ordinances and stuff. But so wildlife conflict often comes from food sources, as we're going to get into. So, you know, when people call me and have an issue, whether it's a concern or question, or they're seeing these animals around their property and they don't know why, you know, I try to ask questions that get us to the root of, well, why are these animals now coming around your property? So defining the problem, is it because you've got, you know, a lot of people, raise your hand, does anyone hear compost? I get a lot of calls from people that compost. You know, they've got a spot out in their backyard and they just take all their food scraps and dump it. Then other people have, you know, fancy containers and legitimately compost like that. But if you're just dumping food scraps out in the yard, you're kind of creating like a food buffet for wildlife, basically. So you may want to think about an enclosure, a fenced-in area, or something to secure those food scraps so you're not attracting unwanted animals. But, you know, in our area, many oak trees produce acorns, pecan trees, persimmon trees, a lot of fruit trees. Wildlife like coyotes are certainly going to be attracted to those natural food sources as well. Unsecured domestic animals. Many people have outdoor cats or indoor outdoor cats. And unfortunately, you know, cats can certainly be a target by coyotes. Feral cats especially, a lot of coastal towns, you know, there's people that put food out for feral cats, and sometimes large feral cat populations can grow as a result of that.
when coyotes move into an area, often what we see are the feral cat population starts declining as a result. So if you do have cats and they're indoor-outdoor pets, you know, keep in mind that they are certainly vulnerable to an animal like a coyote or small dogs that aren't on a leash. Even letting your dog out at night, if coyotes have been seen in your yard and around your property, you know, I would want to go out with my dog and be right there, you know, to supervise my dog and make sure my dog's safe. And if you have anything you want to add at any time, just jump on in, okay?
Well, and even if you have medium-sized dog or, you know, anything larger than that, coyotes will sometimes be really friendly with your dog, and you may end up with koi dog puppies. So, it's not always a hostile relationship there, but
pretty rare. Or maybe just habitat availability. Now, coyotes are not native to North Carolina. They're native to the Midwest, and they made it into the western part of our state, you know, back in the 1980s, and slowly kind of started spreading across our state. They're now found in all 100 counties in our state. And the unique thing about coyotes, from a management standpoint, coyotes can utilize any type of habitat, and they can eat just about anything. So it makes it really difficult to manage an animal like that really doesn't have any natural predators on the landscape anymore. Believe it or not, they love watermelons. I've got a slide in here where they'll chew a hole in the top of a watermelon to where they can get their long pointed muzzle in there, and they'll go to town on a watermelon. So even a cantaloupe maybe from time to time. But so they can live anywhere, they can eat just about anything. And as far as their breeding goes, we'll talk a little bit more about even some physiological adaptations that coyotes, you know, can have triggered. But retention ponds, golf courses, national parks, you know, even landfall up in Wilmington, gated golf course community, they've had pictures and videos of coyotes running across the golf course during broad daylight. So no place is really immune to coyotes. They can show up and exist anywhere. So
the skulls that I'm passing around, and there's also a coyote fur that's being passed around as well. If you look closely at the skulls, you may notice similarity between your teeth and the coyote's teeth, because we're all omnivores, and so you may see the incisors and then the molars and premolars and canines in there as well. And so as Chris was showing previously with the bird seed and things like that, just keep in mind when you're feeding one specific animal, you may buy, you know, bird seed that says for birds. That doesn't translate once you put it out there. And so there's a lot of things that when there's competition for resources, they're going to start to say, can I eat this? It's good. Okay. And so you may be attracting more than just what you're intending to feed. So just keep that in mind. I know if anybody feeds birds, you probably also are a big fan of squirrels, right? So you just kind of have to have patience, because they're all trying to find something to eat too.
That's a really good point. Coyotes eat squirrels. So other animals that could be attracted to your bird feeders could then attract coyotes as well. So that's a really good point, Becky. Here's some examples. Unsecured trash cans. And, you know, most of what I'm talking about tonight as far as food attractants and things is across the board for black bears, for raccoons, possums, you know, many animals that come in and around where humans live and can potentially cause conflict. I just kind of singled out coyotes because that's, I think, why everybody's here tonight. So unsecured trash cans is a really big one. Down in the bottom there, family out having a picnic, that coyote is exhibiting behavior that is really not natural for a wild animal to come that close to humans. So behavior like that, to me, would indicate that people have fed that coyote before, and that coyote has learned some bad behavior. Wild animals should have a healthy respect of humans and keep a safe distance. So that's very alarming behavior right there. And many people, you know, could potentially be bitten by an animal thinking it's tame enough, I'm going to feed them my Snickers bar or something like that, and the animal actually takes a chunk out of their hand. So feeding animals like that, bad idea. Unsecured pet food is a one that a lot of people don't think about. If you have outdoor pets and you feed those animals outside, you know, I encourage people to train your animals. When you put that food down, they have a limited amount of time to eat that food. Anything left over, you pick it up, take it back inside. You eliminate those food availabilities, food resources on the around your property, and there's a good chance that these animals won't be as encouraged to come around. So, but you know, there is a law that our domestic pets be vaccinated to rabies and distemper, and so this is a good reason why. Also, when wild animals are coming in close to our houses, you know, That's something to be mindful about, our children, grandchildren, our domestic pets potentially being exposed to some type of disease. Right? And there's a picture of the watermelon there. See, Coyote can do a number on some watermelon. They love them.
And I was going to add, if you start to notice in your particular neighborhood or on your street, you've seen a lot of coyotes more so than usual. They are highly dispersal, which I'm sure we're going to get into, but if you kind of observe your neighborhood's trash patterns and habits, like everybody pretty much knows, I got to put my trash can out tonight. But if you start to have a lot of human-wildlife interactions like that, you may wait until the morning of to set your trash and things outside. That kind of reduces the window of time for animals to discover it and get habituated towards looking for that as a food source. So that's another way, too, that after a while, if they stroll through and they don't really find something that's like fast food for them, basically, they may just stroll on and move out of the area.
That's a good point, fast food. The further northeast you go in our state, the higher the black bear population goes. And that's crucial, especially certain times of the year. That trash can going out the night before is an easy target for an animal to knock over and get a fast food handout, exactly.
And unfortunately, nowadays, we live in an era where we have all these wonderful TV shows that are out there, and you see people picking up alligators and kissing them and doing things where they're having really inappropriate interactions with wildlife. And unfortunately, that teaches our children who may take those things literally, like you learn a lot of lessons from Disney and stuff like that, and think, oh, I can just go and pick that up and he's just going to love me. Well, no, not everything. If it's wild, it doesn't want to be picked up and it doesn't want to be domesticated or anything like that. So just teaching that healthy respect of keeping a distance, but also that, you know, you just don't want some random person coming up and grabbing you, so, well, hopefully not. So, but there's a lot of TV shows out there that, you know, they're kind of showing a different image and perspective, and it's just not realistic. It puts a lot of people at risk.
Absolutely. These are some of the most common questions that I get as a district biologist. When people call me specifically with coyote issues, you know, where did they come from? What are they like in North Carolina? What impact do they have? And what can we do about them? So, these are some of our objectives with the presentation tonight. I hope nobody leaves tonight with any questions unanswered about coyotes. So let's, as we move on through, I have some examples of coyote food. I mentioned that they can eat anything. They are scavengers, but they're very avid hunters as well. They'll eat berries, insects, poultry, and the feral cat population, like I mentioned. They do really well in agricultural areas. Rabbits, rats, small rodents, anything that's attracted to agricultural areas. So again, something else that makes it very difficult to manage for coyotes. So coyotes in cities, this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. You know, think about how our human population is growing on this planet. You know, human population is kind of growing in an exponential fashion. So as our human population grows, wildlife habitat starts to shrink. So many animals, coyotes, foxes, raccoons, opossums, many of those animals are really becoming adapted to living in and amongst human neighborhoods and subdivisions. This was an example in downtown Chicago, a Quiznos sandwich shop during like main rush lunch time during the day, hot summer day. Coyote walks right in, goes to the back, jumps up into the drink cooler and lays down and takes a nap. And so you can't make this up. There's photographic evidence. And I don't know how to use Photoshop, so it's real, right? So found it on the internet. No, I'm just kidding. The animal control was called after people hit the deck and went running out of the place, you know, obviously. But animal control showed up, got a catch pull on the coyote, walked it out, got it into the truck, and drove away without incident. So was it thirsty? Was it hot? I don't know. But many of these animals are losing their fear of people. And free food handouts, people feeding them, you know, that can be one of the factors that contribute to animals being habituated to living in closer and closer with humans. So there's the big crowd that gathered. But the typical situation in North Carolina, that's what I want to talk about. Not Indiana, not Illinois, not some other state. But in North Carolina, you know, usually one or two family groups is what the complaint is. Coyotes are very territorial. They often will mate for life. They don't travel in packs like they, you know, we might think of the western gray wolf population, Yellowstone, and, you know, the big wolf packs that we hear. In our state, coyotes live in a tight-knit family group. There will be an adult male and a female, and they can have typically 4 to 6 pups in a litter, up to 13 pups in a litter. And sometimes the next year, they may even keep one pup from last year to kind of help them raise the pups from this year. So, but they will defend their territory. So they'll have a den site, And if you kind of draw a circle around that den site, if other coyotes or domestic dogs or other animals that they might feel threatened by come into their home range, they will defend that. So you don't usually have a lot of coyotes living in one small area. The only reason I can think of that might encourage a lot of coyotes to live, you know, sort of peacefully around each other would be if there's just an overabundance of food source. So if there's no limitation on food, then they might not feel as threatened by another family group that lives nearby. But, you know, typically we're going to see a lot of activity. Right now is kind of mating season. They're mating, they're getting ready to den up and have their young. And then as we get into early summer and midsummer, the pups will start leaving the dens on little daily soirees with mom and dad. You know, they're getting more bold, they're playing. You know, they're going to start learning how to hunt as we get into summertime. So by, like, you know, midsummer or so, you know, if a fire truck siren goes off, you know, then, you know, late in the evening, you may hear a lot of yipping and howling if there's coyotes in your area. Pups should disperse, you know, usually late summer into fall are when the pups disperse. So they were born in the spring, come fall, they're already dispersing. And, you know, with some coyotes that have had radio telemetry collars on them, where biologists have been able to track their movements, there have been some young that were born in the spring that dispersed as much as 250, 300 miles away come fall. So they're amazing at how they can travel. And sometimes going right through Raleigh and Greensboro, through, like, you know, urban, more metropolitan type areas. Anywhere there's creek drainages, a lot of cities and towns are building greenways, hiking paths, walking paths, biking trails. Those are little wildlife highways, and animals like coyotes can utilize those to travel great distances. But yeah, 10 to 200 miles is kind of the rough dispersal. But in a community like Curry Beach, where it comes down to a point at Fort Fisher, you know, likely they came from the north, from Wilmington, and they are dispersing like that. That's how I would think they would kind of get up to down here. So they get to Fort Fisher. I doubt they're going to take the ferry across there, which is the other side. But like Emerald Isle, for example, does anyone know where Emerald Isle is up in Carteret County? They had coyotes show up, Evan, maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I think, showed up on Emerald Isle, and right across the high-rise bridge from Emerald Isle's Croatan National Forest. And so, you know, they may have gone across the high-rise bridge at night, or, you know, it's not too far of a swim to swim across the ICW and the marsh and stuff, but they got onto Emerald Isle and started dispersing towards Pine Knoll Shores and Atlantic Beach, and now they're found on the whole Boat Banks Island. So, you know, that's how they disperse like that. So do you have anything you want to add on that? But what I want to show you can see these two are a little smaller. Those two on the left are the adults. And these are two pups here, and this is probably like midsummer. I think this was taken actually in Pine Knoll Shores area. There's some corn. Someone had put corn out, and they got a trail camera picture. This is just a little family group. Might be another pup or so around here somewhere. But this is typically what we see. Two or three coyotes yipping and howling at night can sound like 20 animals. And so I get a lot of calls in summertime. People think they're being overrun by coyotes, but probably it's just a family group out there, and the way their yips and howls travel, it really sounds like a lot more animals. People keep pouring in the back. There might be some room to stand up here if y'all can't see or hear. Come on up. Don't be shy. I would feel comfortable if you stood right next to me so I'm not up here by myself. So, you know, prevention is key. You know, when thinking about safety of your pets, you know, and I have the example of the sheep. That's not a very smart sheep to sniff the coyote through the fence like that. But that sheep could be your dog. It could be your Maltese. It could be your German Shepherd. It could be your cat or your pet rabbit out in the backyard. And so, yeah, I just do want to make the point that, you know, coyotes may look cute, but they are carnivores and they are predators. And if you have outdoor pets, you know, and coyotes have been spotted in your area, you know, you want to be thinking about ways you want to protect your pets, okay? So there's things that we can do around our house. Some of these apply to a more livestock situation, but fencing, you know, a fence in your backyard, and I've been asked many, many times, how high does my fence have to be? And I'm not going to answer that question. I've seen foxes go over an 8-foot high wooden fence. They're a little smaller and more agile than a coyote, but, you know, I've never measured how high a coyote can jump. I know they're pretty agile, though. So, you know, how high of a fence do you need? I don't know. But a fence can certainly help. Motion detecting floodlights, you know, anything that kicks on. Typically, a lot of these animals that start coming in closer to houses, they start at nighttime, and if they're being rewarded with food, they may start to get more bold and start coming during the daytime. So at night, you know, any big floodlights that kick on, if there's movement, that can help. If you have a lot of brush in your backyard, if you back up to a creek or a forest, you know, a lot of brush like that can attract rabbits and other animals that coyotes might view as a food source. So you could think about maybe clearing some of the brush. Let's see what else. But, you know, when losses occur, either a pet has been attacked or you've been confronted out walking your dog and a coyote that won't leave you alone and they're following you. You know, sometimes that is aggressive behavior, and sometimes as a biologist, seasonally, I might think, well, that's defensive behavior. They may have a den site nearby and they view your dog as a threat because it's another canine. And so they might just be following you until you're out at a safe distance away from their den area and their home site. So seasonally, there can be different behavior traits and stuff. But, you know, if a coyote does come on your property and causes damage, you know, anything like that, there are resources for you out there. It's not just, oh, well, I've got this animal and I got to stay in my house now if I'm going to be safe. So you can call me and we can help you with some of those. So here's some options of what you can do. Basically, there's kind of three things you can do. Do nothing, or you can take a non-lethal approach or a lethal approach. And we're going to kind of break those down and talk about them. From a non-lethal approach, you know, I make a lot of site visits a year. If somebody calls me and says I'm having problems around my property with animals, I'm not going to blow that person off. I'm going to ask questions and really get to the root of, you know, what type of animal are we talking about, or animals, was there damage, you know, what's going on. And often I'll even make a site visit. You know, I might be able to walk around and say, oh, well, there's, you know, two persimmon trees in your backyard, there's oaks over there with acorns everywhere, you know, you've got a barbecue grill that you never clean, it smells like steak all the time. Anyway, I may be able to spot things on a site visit, and I can help educate those people about, you know, modifications to their behavior around their property that can help minimize conflict, okay? Human behavior modifications, it's the older we get, the harder it is to change, right? But many things that we can do, little things that we can do around our property can go a long ways to minimizing conflicts with wildlife, not just coyotes. But animal husbandry, that's just a general term for, you know, nighttime would be when your domestic pets might be most at risk. And so, you know, bringing your cats inside at night would decrease your cat's chances of being attacked by a predator at nighttime, obviously. You know, going outside with your dog at night on a leash to let them use the bathroom so you're right there instead of just letting them out and going and finishing your TV program and then going and looking for your dog. So animal husbandry techniques, it's things that we can do to make our pets safer.
And on that note, if you are walking your dog at night and anything like that and you are concerned that you may be approached by a coyote, you can bring things like noisemakers or something like that. Coyotes are very responsive to sensory things, which is why I think like floodlights and any kind of change in the area that's sudden, they kind of, it throws them, because then it puts them on the defensive. But just something that can, you don't want something, I see people walking dogs that carry a big stick or a baseball bat. If it's that close to me, my odds are dropping. Not that a coyote, I don't think you do all right. Y'all look pretty tough. But if you have a noisemaker or something, that way you don't have to get closer to that animal to kind of scare it off, or at least make it back up and say, oh, never mind, I'm not that curious anymore. So just consider bringing something like that. And it's also good, too, because if there's somebody else in the area, and if you do need help for any reason, just for your own personal safety, not even with coyotes, just walking around, it'll at least call attention to you and hopefully bring others around you.
That's an excellent point. And that reminds me of something that I wanted to say. And so what if you're in your kitchen, you know, doing dishes at the sink and you look out and there's a coyote in your yard? Now, what do? I'll tell you, the instinct of many people nowadays is to pull out their phone and take a picture of it, you know? So if you do something like that, or real quietly open up your door and try to, you know, get a better look at it, that animal doesn't feel threatened at all, okay? I love wildlife, obviously. I became a biologist, right? But if you do not want these animals around your property, those animals need to understand the boundaries that maybe this isn't the safest place for me to be. So like Becky was talking about, you know, noisemakers, things like that. If I see a coyote in my yard and I don't want it there, I'm going to let it know I don't want it there. I'm going to go flying out my door. Bah! You know, I'm going to do something like that. Sorry if I scared you. I'm going to have pots and pans banging, making noises. And I've got all kinds of big conch shells and whelk shells on my deck, actually all over my house. And so I'm going to grab one of those and throw it, you know, something like that to make that animal go, whoa, maybe it's not a good idea to come sniffing around this property, okay? You know, animals, if they get injured, you know, they don't have the luxury of going, you know, to, you know, the hospital or to the clinic to get stitched up or get their broken arm fixed. And so everything that they do has to be very calculated. If I'm going to go and sniff around for food at that house, you know, is it worth my trouble? Could I get hurt? You know, they're not consciously thinking that, but it's something that just intuitively goes through their head. And so if you come flying out like Tasmanian devil, likely that animal, unless it's been very habituated to getting food from people, you know, likely that animal is going to run away. And that would be the behavior that we would hope to see and expect to see of a wild animal. So, but just tiptoeing out, pulling out your phone to take pictures, they're going to be like, oh, okay, I walked through that yard and nothing happened. They just kind of looked at me and stuff. So, So education is critical. You know, Becky's a regional education specialist. A big part of my job as a district biologist is education. Our website has a tremendous amount of very, very good educational information, not just on coyotes, but snakes, alligators, you name it, birds. Becky brought some stuff here. I'm going to let you talk about that after the program. You know, easy stuff you can find on our website that can, you know, show you everything to do around your house to minimize conflicts.
Including a wildlife hotline, tip line, which is actually manned by biologists. Even though you're calling Raleigh, you're not just going to get some intern waiting to pass the summer. You'll actually get somebody who knows what they're talking about and can also talk to you about what's going on. And then a lot of those reports and things get filtered to our biologists, our education specialists and things. So that way you can get quick answers, or we can at least point you to a more direct resource that you can talk to get the issue resolved or to, you know, satiate your curiosity.
That's a great point. Our wildlife conflict hotline was created a little over two years ago, I think. We've got 3 full-time biologists that staff it, but it is 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. Do wildlife issues only happen Monday through Friday? No, they don't. So hence, you know, Becky comes in, she works a lot of weekends. I come in as district biologist, I work a lot of weekends. And then New Hanover County also has 2 wildlife enforcement officers, Officer Murphy Hall and Officer Clayton Ludwig. And so, you know, that's a common thing that I hear from folks when they have a wildlife conflict or a wildlife issue on their property. They don't know who to call. And so they call 911. And then, you know, the police department or sheriff's department says, well, you know, that's a wild animal. You got to talk to wildlife or animal control. And they refer them to animal control. And then the person calls animal control. And the animal control is like, is it a dog or a cat? It's not mine. You know, call wildlife, you know. And so many times when people finally get to me, who they should have talked to begin with, they've already talked to 2, 3, 4 people, and they're kind of frustrated at that point. And I sense the frustration. So I encourage you, please, before you leave tonight, make sure you have our contact information. You know, I live 2.5 hours north in Craven County. I'm in New Hanover County a lot. But if you have an immediate need for assistance, you know, we always have a wildlife officer on duty, you know, and we work closely with the sheriff's department. So you call me. If I'm out of town, I'll put you in touch with a wildlife officer that's on duty, or, you know, 911 or something like that. We'll get you in touch with somebody to help you, okay? So lethal tools, you know, coyotes are very smart animals, but I guarantee if you're having problems around your property with coyotes and you just ask them to leave, they're probably not going to leave, okay? So sometimes more aggressive measures are required. And so because of how difficult it is to manage for coyotes, you know, sometimes if their population, you know, gets too much, as I mentioned, there's no natural predators left on the landscape for coyotes. And so sometimes, you know, lethal measures might be required, especially if, you know, a pet has been attacked, or, you know, they're starting to damage property or something like that, okay? We try to modify our behavior. If that doesn't correct the problem, sometimes as a last resort, lethal tools like trapping and hunting might be needed. So I have depredation permits listed on the bottom, and I'll discuss that first. So we have a designated trapping season in our state, December 1 to the end of February, okay? So if something occurs outside of the regular lawful trapping season, to do any type of trapping or removal of a coyote, a nuisance coyote that's damaged property or threatened a pet or something like that, a depredation permit would be required, okay? Now, my agency years ago essentially said, okay, well, coyotes can be taken with a firearm day or night 365 days a year. They are a non-native species in our state, an invasive predatory species, and so people should be allowed to manage that animal on their property. However, if you live anywhere along here, discharge of a firearm is probably not lawful. So trapping may be your only issue if you need to remove a nuisance coyote from your property. So depredation permit, you would contact me if there's been damage or a pet injured or pet threatened. I would issue a permit to you. There's no fee for that. And then either you could remove the animal yourself, or you, if you had a trapper friend or knew a trapper, they could do the trapping on your property. Or there's people in our state called wildlife damage control agents. They have to take a two-day class from our agency to become certified to do what they do. And most of them, that's their livelihood. They're you know, they'll trap and remove squirrels out of your attic, or you know, raccoons that are nesting under your house chewing your insulation. I mean, you know, any kind of wildlife nuisance issue, those individuals are licensed by my agency and they can come to you. You can contract them to, you know, to deal with your coyote issue. They can issue the permit to you and do the trapping and removal for you. Hunting probably isn't going to be an option for down in this area, I would imagine. Maybe archery equipment, but you need to review your local laws, you know, things like that to see if that's even a lawful way. But firearm, I would say probably not. So trapping might be your best bet as far as that goes. And there's many people that are adamantly opposed to trapping and think it's very inhumane. I do want to just kind of take one step forward and say, you know, anyone trapping to remove coyotes still have to follow all of the state trapping laws and regulations. They have to follow our best management practices. Even though it is to lethally remove an animal, it still has to be done humanely. And so essentially, the most common traps that I see trappers use would be like the foothold trap that grabs their toes and holds them in place until the trapper arrives the next day and can humanely euthanize the animal. But sometimes, if it becomes a big enough problem, lethal options are the only way. And so, I don't know if you have anything to add on that.
Well, as Chris brought up before, how we've tracked some of them, put radio collars on them, and seen that they move hundreds of miles, relocation is just not an option. We're also running out of places. We get calls, I don't know about Chris, but I'll get calls, and people seem to think there's some fictional Disneyland of that I could just let them go there and they'll live out the rest of their days. But we're cohabitating with a lot of wildlife, and we are developing a lot of the areas that they were the first locals, the first natives. So it's one of those things where we have to learn to coexist with them. And that's why we bring up first the non-lethal and then, unfortunately, the lethal methods when that comes into play. Because another reason that we pay attention to population distribution and how things are moving, we also take things like public health into consideration. So when you talk about vaccinating your animals or having wildlife interact with your domestic pets and things, we like to keep track of that just to see what's going on in our own communities in that respect. But relocation is not really an option for coyote management, for population management anyway. And you heard how many pups they have, so that would be, we'd have to have a staff just doing that, and honestly they just walk their way back or swim their way back anyhow. So that's why you don't see that as an option up here.
Well, and it's unlawful. Any animal that's considered a rabies vector species, so typically we think of foxes, raccoons, skunks, coyotes, any animal that has a high prevalence of rabies or a likelihood to transmit rabies, it's unlawful to live trap and relocate somewhere else. And it's the disease spread, like she was just mentioning. If you take rabies from one place and release that animal in another location, all of those animals can now be affected with rabies. And so coyotes have a lower prevalence of rabies. Since 1990, these are statistics that, you know, that we keep track of, and since 1990, you know, I can only think of 15 or 16 coyotes, I believe, now, that have tested positive for rabies, versus, you know, raccoons would be 8,000-9,000, you know, foxes a little bit behind raccoons. So, you know, they have a lower prevalence of rabies, but any mammal can get rabies. And, you know, for those of you that don't know it, that's a non-curable disease. If you get rabies and don't get immediate treatment, it is fatal 100% of the time. So trapping and relocating, not an option, even legally an option,
Chris,
for that. So.
Our commission did just approve the start of trapping season to go to November 1st.
November 1st.
So now we actually have an extra month. So there's 4 months in which trapping can occur.
And that will start next year, obviously. February 28th was the end of trapping season this year. So next year, thank you, Evan, November 1st, it will start up next year. And it always runs to the end of February. So, all right. Well, we'll probably come back to that slide. But matching up the tool in the toolbox to the actual issue that's going on, you know, is really important. I just want to say one thing. Like, you know, not all coyotes, you know, I would say are going to cause damage. You know, I've actually heard old school ranchers out west, you know, that border Yellowstone and big country out there, you know, sheep ranchers and cattle ranchers out there, I've heard some of them say, you know, sometimes coyotes will move into my area and they don't attack our livestock, but they will defend that territory to other coyotes coming into the area that might be inclined to attack. So if I trap and remove those coyotes, the new coyotes that come in may desire my sheep or my cattle, you know. So coexistence, you know, yeah, to some extent we are going to have to learn to coexist with wildlife, but if there is, you know, a problem with an attack or property damage, you know, we all have the right to protect our families and to protect our property as well. I think that's about the last slide. Let's see. So I wasn't really going to get in too much on trapping, but this is what an animal looks like that has a foothold trap on its foot. You know, the old steel teeth traps that we heard about or saw, you know, back in the 70s, these traps are required to have offset jaws or padded jaws so it doesn't cut the blood circulation off of the arm or leg of the animal. So it's essentially just designed to detain the animal long enough for the trapper to get there. So as I said here, eradication of coyotes, probably not going to happen, but managing coyote populations to what would be considered a socially acceptable level, you know, that's what we would hope to do. The trapping techniques especially can be very effective if there's an individual coyote that's, you know, coming around your property and has, you know, growled at your pets or threatened you. You know, trapping, targeting a specific nuisance individual might be a better option for some people. Let's see. So I do want to add one thing here at the end. What do we do if we encounter a wild animal? You know, I've already mentioned that food availability is usually number one that causes wildlife conflicts with humans. So should you encounter any wild animal, please don't feed them and enjoy them from a safe distance. You know, one thing that you all have to deal with living on a beautiful coastal town, you know, the migrant human population. So the tourist season is getting ready to start up. And I say this, I've been a tourist my whole life. You know, I love to travel and go places. But often, you know, tourists, people who aren't familiar with an area, they go for a weekend, they go for a week, they're having fun, they're not thinking about other things, you know. They might not be thinking about securing their trash and their trash bags that they put out, you know, on the back deck that an animal can tear open and get into. They might not even think twice about throwing chicken legs off the deck at foxes and coyotes and stuff out there. But then they get to leave after their vacation's over, and you're the residents, you know, and so you have to deal with the ramifications of other people's actions. And so some of the coastal towns that I've interacted with and talked about coyote issues, now, I strongly encourage them to talk with local realtors that, you know, are assisting people with planning their family vacations to your area to include a piece on wildlife safety and what not to do, what to do around their rental property when they come for a visit. You know, if you have trash pickup ordinances in your community, you know, putting your cans out the morning of as opposed to the night before. There are things that you can do, you know, with the local tourism industry to try to educate people. Signage is really good in apartment and condominium complexes. Simple signs that say, you know, what not to do to help prevent wildlife conflict. So as local residents, you know, y'all can take the lead on things like that, and that will be an immediate benefit to you folks that live here year-round and have to deal with that. Did you want to?
Well, and also the prevailing attitude. I have, like Chris, been a tourist in some areas, and you go, and it's a little more nature friendly. And there's just, when you visit a place, like I'm sure the reason you bought on Curry Beach or Carolina Beach, wherever you're coming from today, is there was a vibe. There was something that attracted you to that particular area. And especially being such a high density tourist destination, if people come here to visit and they understand, hey, you know, everybody that lives here leads by example. They don't do this, this, and this, or it's discouraged. It kind of sends that signal where they want to fit in, they want to feel welcome, so they're going to try to not go out of there. Now, don't get me wrong, there's always those few. Yeah. I know. I've heard stories about Carolina Beach in particular, but if you kind of set up that kind of precedent or that mood or that feeling, even just in interacting with people, as they ask you, hey, where's a great place to eat? Be like, oh, you know, and then you can kind of inject a little something. But that goes a long way, too, in terms of the kind of people that you continue to attract back, ideally. I know you can't control everything, but it helps.
Yeah, it definitely helps. So feeding wildlife, you know, I really harp on this because alligators is a classic example. When I do a site visit on an alligator to a neighborhood retention pond, I walk up to the edge and that alligator is sunning itself on the other side of the pond, gets in the water and swims right to me. That's not natural alligator behavior. Somebody's been throwing food I got ahead of myself there. So if you see behavior like that, I'm not encouraging you to go and punch that person in the face or confront them, you know, but through signage, and alligators is a classic example. If you have a neighborhood pond and alligators kind of throughout seasonally, you know, might show up for a week or two and then move on, posting a sign, you know, please do not feed wildlife in your community. Signage, sometimes people actually look at those, you know, so it can help. But with coyotes too, with foxes, you know, encouraging people not to sign to feed them. Sometimes I get calls from neighbors that say, my neighbor puts corn piles out because he loves to see wildlife. Well, that creates a conflict with the person living beside them if they don't want those animals in their yard. So sometimes I'm not going to get in the middle of neighborly disputes and stuff, but we do have wildlife enforcement officers, and particularly with alligators, since they're federally protected species, if people are feeding them, that's against the law. You know, so you can call our 1-800-662-7137 number. You can report it anonymously, and a wildlife officer will make a site visit and write them a ticket if it is something that they're doing unlawfully. But I got ahead of myself. That's why we don't want to feed wildlife. So it's just not safe for the residents that live here year-round.
You know? Most of it's not nutritionally good for that animal either. You see a lot of people that'll feed birds like bread and things like that.
Potato
it's not
chips.
Good for them. And then you're conditioning them, like you're right. Chris was saying, that behavior. But we were talking about creating wildlife habitat, and you can do that. There's all kinds of things you can look up on the internet, and we can talk about it afterwards. But if you are desiring certain interactions with animals, just keep in mind what the components, what attracts that animal, components of habitat, so food, water, shelter, and space in a suitable arrangement. So for instance, say you don't want to walk out and accidentally have a snake right next to your driveway. Look at your yard. Do you have a lot of brush piles and things nearby that they can take shelter in? You know, if you have a yard and you have a space to do things, then you can arrange it in such a way that you will kind of attract wildlife to one portion of it more so than the other. And you have a way to kind of to figure that out so that maybe you can feel a little bit better about walking around and things like that. But also keeping in mind that things change and they're moving. And as Chris said, what your neighbors are doing is also going to impact your efforts, unfortunately. So, and I'll let him tell you about this.
Good points on that. I did want to put up some sources of information for you, similar to what Becky brought as far as handouts. Technical guidance, you know, she's got some handouts she'll go over there. This is our website is right here, ncwildlife.org, and if you just put a /coyote on the end of that, it'll take you to the place of our website where we have our coyote management plan. It'll also take you to a couple of documents. One is really interesting. It's like the biology and life history of coyotes. You can learn how long they live, what they eat, you know, how many pups they have, all the stuff that we tried to go over tonight. A lot of information, but then the how to avoid conflicts as well. Contact information for us is on our website. Landowner assistance, as I mentioned, if you want to develop wildlife habitat on your property because you love seeing the critters coming around, we can help you with that. The trapper assistance, there is a list of licensed trappers in our state. You can search by county if that is something that you're interested on your property due to close encounters or they're causing damage on your property and you've already modified your behavior and you're at your last resort. You can find a list of licensed trappers and then also a list of the wildlife damage control agents. You know, those are the folks that have to take the 2-day class from my agency to be able to assist people with wildlife damage. One thing that I didn't put on here is wildlife rehabilitators.
We're getting into springtime when all animals on the landscape tend to have little babies, so little cute fuzzy things around. If you see a baby fox or a baby coyote or a baby raccoon and think it's orphans, please don't pick those animals up, okay? For several reasons. One, it's against the law to possess wildlife without a permit from my agency. Two, we've talked about the disease issues. You know, you could wrap that animal in a towel and bring it home and now expose your whole family and potentially other people to wildlife disease. We have people in our state called wildlife rehabilitators, and they have to also get a license from our agency to operate every year. And they have training on how to take care of animals, and the idea is to rehab them or repair them if they've been damaged and hopefully release them back into the wild. However, as I mentioned earlier, the rabies vector species, you know, currently they cannot take rabies vector species. So it would be animals that aren't considered rabies vector that they would be able to receive. But there are options out there. So if you see a baby fawn on the side of the road or in your backyard, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's abandoned. You know, if you are concerned because you've seen it there for a couple days and you haven't seen mom around, you know, give me a call, give a wildlife enforcement officer a call, give Becky a call. We can make a site visit and hopefully be able to make that determination that this animal, you know, truly is abandoned or if it's been injured and needs assistance, and if we can even do that for that animal.
And that season is going to change the behavior. So we're up here, and of course nature is kind of a crapshoot, and that we can say it's going to happen, and then there'll be that one animal that does it differently. But it's like anything else. If you have your children or your grandchildren or anybody you care about around you, especially somebody younger, and you're taking care of them, you're going to be a little more on edge, a little more defensive. So maybe they won't back down as easily as they might have if they didn't have young there. I've come across a baby coyote before, and I thought he was orphaned, but really the mother was just redenning. And so she'll come back and kind of collect her pups as she goes. So as Chris was saying, give them wide berth and some space and some time, but also just acknowledge that, you know, if you are coming to try to take efforts, that it is the breeding season, and just keep observing them and see if they do have young there. And if they do, you know, it just, you don't want to take the mother away when she's taking care of her young and that kind of thing. So, but that's where we can kind of help and consult on those kinds of things as well. But just keep that in mind, that during that season, just be more vigilant about what you're doing and keeping animals on leash and things.
That's a really good point. I think that was my last slide there. So hopefully everybody stayed awake. I'm going to back up to this one because Becky has a few things that she wants to share with y'all as far as educational materials, and then we'll get to some questions, definitely.
I just want to point out, I really undershot the crowd tonight, but I brought some handouts that we have on our website. It's talking about coexisting with coyotes, and actually, in the past, our website has been a bit of a nightmare, but now it's a lot better. And so if you go to ncwildlife.org, we have all these little tabs. Some of them are slightly redundant, but if you go to learning, you can actually go. You'll see education centers, species, things like that. If you go to species, and it may take a minute, and coyotes are mammals, so we'll click on that. And you can actually, any of these species profiles, if you want to know about their life histories, how they got here, how old they live, you know, all those things, but they've got coyote here. And so you can go under there, and that's where you can find this handout. So if for people that want to actually have a handheld to take home, I have 30 copies of these, but it's not a fire sale. You can find it online, so don't rush. And I did have some leftover magazines. This is from our photography contest. It's something we put out. This is a January-February edition, so we'll have the March-April coming out pretty soon. But in these, it just kind of talks about the work that the Wildlife Resources Commission does as far as habitat conservation, species conservation, and education throughout the state, not just here on the coastal plains. This particular one, in every thing, they have like a little one-pager to help teach you about what's going on, or something that's just fun to share, usually an activity with kids. But in this one, they teach you how to make bat boxes or bat houses, which is something neat too. But they have a lot of wonderful pictures, and some of the categories are things like animal behavior. So another thing that we kind of didn't bring up, but animal photography, it's springtime. There's going to be a lot of things moving, and like I said, with the young, everybody's really tempted to take risks that they wouldn't ordinarily take. So to get that perfect shot, you may move just a little bit closer. Just pay attention to animals and how they're behaving. If they seem agitated, if they're talking a lot, they're not happy. So just back up and give them a lot of space there. If you are interested in other wildlife programs or places you can go to access and see wildlife safely and learn about them in that environment and be outside. I also have some of these little brochures here as well as my business card if you'd like to get in touch with me. Or if you have groups, I'll also come and talk to homeowners associations, just enthusiast groups, whoever basically wants to take the time and learn about the wonders that we have here in North Carolina. I'm very happy to share that. But if there's also some hesitation or some nerves about a particular species, please let me know, because that's, again, going back to education, and that's the very first weapon that we have in our toolbox there. But beyond that, we do have several education centers throughout the state. If you ever go out to the western part of the state, we have Pisgah National Forest. They have an educational center in there that's fantastic. They also have a trout hatchery, I believe, over there. Then we also have here on the coast at Fayetteville, Peckman Center. So if you're interested in learning how to fish or fly fishing or anything like that, they do kayak fishing now up there as well. It's a great educational center. And then up in Raleigh, we have what we call our education hub. So a nice little center that you can walk through and kind of learn the history of our organization as well as wildlife and things through there. And I was going to say, if there's an interest in wildlife workshops, you can contact me directly. Or there's a great website called EE North Carolina, all spelled out, .org. And it'll tell you about all kinds of different outdoor experiences and wildlife classes and things like that that you can do in the great outdoors, most of which are free. So if you're looking for a way to meet other people or enthusiasts out there to get outside and enjoy nature, that's another thing. But so that's kind of, I know you have a lot of questions, which is why you came here tonight. So I think we'll go ahead and open it up.
Sure.
And don't scream at us too much.
Our garbage cans open. Mm-hmm. They're in.
Right.
I guess a black bear could get into them, but can a coyote, do we need to put a rock on top?
I mean, you can. I don't know how aggressive they're going to be if it's closed. If you take your trash out every week, I don't know how many parties you're having, but if it's not, you know, where it won't close, usually it's enough. And if you are curious about that, honestly, if you have one that's excessively full, you can set it out the morning of. If you have that kind of time, and then there's a lot of movement. We've got even on Curie Beach rush hour traffic a little bit too. So that'll kind of dissuade any kind of interaction. But I think it's for people that leave it out there for, you know, a day or two at a time, or they just leave the lid off and they don't mess with it. We don't have too many, correct me if I'm wrong, but incidences of black bears getting into our trash cans down around here, just because, I mean, like Chris was saying, unless they take the ferry or unless they're, you know, renting a condo on the beachfront, they're not really here. You have to go more to the northeastern corner for that. But for the coyotes, I don't think you necessarily have to worry about it. If you start to see them around a little bit more, they may be chasing more accessible foods like rats or anything like that, or even the feral cats that are around, or outdoor pet food. There's honestly enough people that feed their pets and leave their food and water. So a water bowl, you'll see a lot of wildlife that will come and enjoy that as well. And that is enough to kind of keep them busy, where I haven't noticed them really getting into the trash cans. But if you start to notice, And all animals are pretty social, and coyotes are pretty social as well. So they tend to teach each other things too. So if you see one animal with a bad habit, just pay attention and see how you can adapt.
Are there any animals on the island that are natural enemies of coyotes?
They typically don't have any natural predators on the landscape in our area.
They do tend to compete with our foxes, though. So our native gray fox, they compete for the food and for habitat with them. And so since we don't have that top predator for them, that's another reason their population is gotten out of control.
Our foxes have disappeared down here.
This temper is a lot
of us. All the fields here, and we have regularly, even on cloudy days, we have the coyotes yipping in groups of two and three, and we've lost, I'm not sorry to say we've lost the raccoons, but we've lost the raccoons. We have just the occasional possum, and the feral cat population was knocked down real hard when somebody poisoned them over here with antifreeze. But since that time, I don't know whether it's the spay and release program was really successful, but they're gone.
Well, you bring up a good point. You know, coyotes can do a number on feral cat populations. I work closely with county and municipal animal control agencies. And over the last 2 years, there has been a lot of canine distemper in New Hanover County. I think I got my first call from New Hanover County Animal Protective Services
I want to say it was like November 2 years ago, and they had seen several months in a row of elevated numbers of calls from people with particularly sick raccoons and sick foxes. And, you know, whereas they might answer in a month's time on average 5 to 8 calls, there were some months where they were getting as many as 30, and they were really concerned. And so I came down and worked with them, and I encouraged them to save some of the fresh carcasses that they, because they were having to go and euthanize these animals, because they were laid in the front yard with discharge from the eyes, just balled up in a ball. You could tell something was wrong with them. And so, but distemper and rabies can kind of manifest similarly. But anyway, so I encouraged them to collect 5 fresh samples for me of raccoons and foxes all over New Hanover County, and I packaged them up. A lot of what I do as a district biologist is wildlife disease surveillance, and I sent all of those off to the wildlife disease lab that we work with, University of Georgia, and 100% of them came back positive with canine distemper. And so what we saw is we kind of mapped it out, and I think the highest month may have had like 63 calls that they got on sick raccoons and foxes. And so you'll see an increase and increase, and then all of a sudden it sort of drops off as it goes through, and it can really do a number on animals like foxes and raccoons in particular. In the animal kingdom, size, often will outcompete smaller animals, and coyotes typically are larger than foxes. And so if they're in an area and there's a confrontation, usually the coyote is going to win. And so you could see a displacement of foxes in an area if coyotes move in to that.
Do we have to be concerned about like leptospirosis or other vector, coyotes serving as vectors? We're out in the woods here, and we've got the water, mm-hmm. and we certainly vaccinate our animals against leptospirosis. How about us cruising around in such close proximity? Because we can't get away from them down here all the way down through the green space to the park. They're here always, and they're out there pooping, and you can see their poop. And you've emphasized avoidance for us, sure. But really, this is a really enclosed space. This is not like having national forest land for them to roam around on. Mm-hmm. We're having encounters that they're so bold, they stop in our lot and just look at us when we pull up at night. They're not afraid. Now, have they tried to attack me? No. I'm not concerned about the dingo getting my baby. But at the same time, I am concerned about exposure to disease and having a wild animal that's big enough so that it could hurt me on my own private property. Mm-hmm. I don't like it.
Well, you saw the slide that I showed. I mean, the entire western half of this landmass is all open areas, and so there's a lot of critters. There was a black bear walking down the street in a neighborhood, I believe that was 2 years ago, in Carolina Beach, and so there are animals in this area.
But that's an indigenous animal. That's not an invasive species. These are sort of different.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we intentionally put up lethal means of management. Should you, as a landowner, feel threatened by these animals if they're damaging your property, threatening your pets or something, there are those options available.
And I'm accustomed to that in a farm or ranch Montana situation. Mm-hmm. Down here in a subdivision with a 6,500 square foot lot, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I live in a subdivision in Craven County and had a 300-pound bear walk through my backyard. I've got coyotes in my backyard. I go out with my dog at night, and it's just because I know that there's critters around. So, even though you say you're on a small lot in a residential area, if there's food sources around, then those animals could potentially be here. So,
and what's so strange is we've been down here 20 years, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until 8 or 9 years ago that we even saw the first coyote. Yeah.
That would make sense as far as dispersal goes. It took them that long to get down here.
And development.
Yeah.
And it's where the food is where they're going to stay. If they won't make a territory somewhere, they can't make a living. So, I don't know how many people around here are fans of fences and things like that, if that ruins the aesthetic, but, it could help. But even just talking to the people that live around you and just understanding if they leave food out and things like that, also a fresh water source is going to be a fixture. It's going to be calling everything in to get a drink of water. Is there I mean, have you seen it year-round? Are they around
year-round? Yeah, they're year-round. They're year-round. I could take you out tonight and come walk the dog with us. I know the state park tried to do some remediation, and they took out the charcoal, the grills down there, where people would barbecue and then leave 30 bags of trash.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the solution to that was none of us can go to the park and barbecue under the trees anymore. Right, that's why we can't have nice things, exactly. But the question then is there any plan for determining what the population is down here? Or how long, you know?
It's more of a presence-absence thing. You know they're here, so does it matter if there's 5 or 10?
I think it does, doesn't it?
Well, you know, from a management standpoint, I mean, if they're causing issues on property, then the individual property owner certainly has the right to manage that animal on their property. And so with the tools that we provided, you could easily hire a wildlife damage control agent off season or during trapping season. You could, you know, get a trapper to come and probably trap for free on your property. And so, you know, we have tried to lift all hurdles from a state agency standpoint, allowing people to hunt them 365 days a year, day or night. You know, we're not standing in your way for managing coyotes on your property. Basically, we're trying to give you the tools, you know, so you can make the educated decision on your property, what is best for your property as far as that goes. She had her hand up just a minute ago. Need to move on because I saw a lot of hands.
Along these same lines, I have a very fluffy cedar tree, and during warm weather, something fairly large likes to sleep under there at night.
It's not him, is it?
Something still slept under there. Okay. Is there anything you can buy that, you know, to sprinkle around or whatever that would keep them, whatever it is, away without hurting, without killing the animal or killing the neighbor's pets?
I mean, that's a good question. I know, like, to get rid of moles, they don't like castor oil, something that smells terrible like that. You could try castor oil. There are some neat contraptions and devices out there that I've heard of, like a spark away. It's a little motion sensor thing that you can mount on a pole in an area specific if you know a certain spot. And if something walks past it, it puts out this really loud crackle noise like a lightning strike, followed by like the smell of ozone. So it's kind of, you know, intended to mimic a lightning strike. And, you know, there's videos on their website of big bears being run off of trash cans because of one of those. You know, there's a lot of things out there on the market that...
The key to that is figuring out what animals you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And we can get you better guidance. And if you know somebody that has a trail camera,
yeah, that's
something
a good idea.
That can set it up. If we actually knew what species you were dealing with, we could probably give you some
pretty solid recommendations. And the solution would probably just be a light source. Having some sort of a light that's directed in that area.
Yeah, and I thought Duke Energy had taken care of that, but only shines in our window, not
in that. Well, even if you got a flashlight, that you can kind of point that gentleman at you for a couple nights and see if it's enough to kind of force them on down the line, you know, as long as it's not in your neighbor's eyes. Yeah.
We've got another question in the back here. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that the dodo in the Walker line.
Yes, sir.
How did they get it? Did it migrate? Or?
Becky, do you have that migration of coyotes there?
And why did they wait till the 80s to come?
Hairstyles changed.
Hairstyles changed, exactly. Basically, the migration of coyotes have been tracked from the Midwest, kind of coming up and over from the Northeast, down through the Southeast, up to the Northeast, down through the Southeast, making their way across. But just in a nutshell, you know, 1600s, people moving from the East Coast westward, clearing timber, planting agriculture, creating good coyote habitat. Yeah. So as people were moving westward, coyotes started moving eastward. They just didn't show up in our state until then. So,
fur trades and hunting, and just we made migration corridors available to them. We built bridges, we built roads. They're great swimmers. You know, they swim right over the Mississippi River. So they're going to go where, as we eliminate their predators, they're going to go where they're not harassed all the time. In 83 and 85, the state or the counties in orange are where you would find them.
These are documented reports.
Actual credible sightings. And then 1990,
start to see them moving. And they, you know, you may see that they're skipping some of these areas. If we had a map that overlaid this, you'd see more of the interstate system and things there, which may make it a little bit more difficult for them and some of those areas that are highly developed. But then you'll see pretty quickly that doesn't matter anymore. And see, by 2005, we were pretty much overrun with them. And that's why we give you multiple management strategies. They're here. They may be invasive, but they don't know that. So they're staying, and they're part of the landscape now. So.
The Outer Banks Island chains are still yellow at that point, but they're orange now.
They're there, yes.
Are bright lights a deterrent? To keep that, like, if I live on a golf course, and I have floodlights around my house. If I turn my floodlights on at night, will that induce them to go onto the golf course to do their walking?
It may be new enough to them where they're like, whoa, this is different, I'm not so sure, and then they don't feel as protected, they're not walking like under the cover of night, but since they don't have many predators, they're still maybe a little fearful, but the idea is to get something new for them. So if you just put your floodlight on every night when you go to bed, you know, it's like your neighbors, and be like, oh, well, that's Jane's floodlight, you know, we don't worry about it. But if you have something kind of new or you can mix it up a little bit, it might change it. But if you haven't had a floodlight there before and you turn it on when you start to notice them out there, or if you think that's around the time that you see them, not necessarily leave it on all night, that might be something where they get a little freaked out. Not guaranteed. It comes down to the individual personality.
Just like if you live around a train, you know, it might be annoying at first, but you get habituated to it. So mixing things up has been found to be more effective.
And using different layers, so like lights and fences, or, you know, not just using one thing at a time. And a customized, yeah.
Yes, sir, in the back.
Are you aware of any tracking programs going on at the state park?
Fort Fisher State Park?
Yep.
Yes, sir, I think they apply for an annual depredation permit for wildlife, specifically like foxes and coyotes, and I think due to like ground nesting birds, different things like that. They do apply for that on an annual basis, and they have a licensed trapper that performs that. You know, for example, and I'm glad you brought that up, because like the Fort Fisher Aquarium, the assistant director contacted me, I think back in late November, early December, and there was a coyote in the parking lot, like approaching vehicles. And, you know, as we mentioned in the presentation, that's not normal coyote behavior. So, you know, somebody obviously offered food to that animal, and that animal was losing its fear of people. So that's a perfect example of when a situation like trapping and removal might be very good before somebody gets bitten or something.
Under the depredation permit, is there an obligation for them to report how many coyotes that have been removed?
Yes, sir. At the end of the year, typically it's a calendar year. They apply for the permit in December. It usually starts in January. And then at the end of the year, at the expiration of their permit, they would report the number of animals that are caught.
It seems like the numbers on that end of the island have dramatically, you don't see as many sightings as what we were seeing. But my other question is, different species altogether, are you aware of any red wolves in this area?
No, sir, I'm not. Someone else mentioned something to me earlier about a wolf, you know, being spotted in Fort Fisher, and I have no knowledge of a wolf this far down. You know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that has been responsible for the Eastern Red Wolf Reintroduction Project, you know, it's up in the northeastern part of our state, the five counties way up near the Virginia border up there. And I don't know, Evan, if you've heard of anything. I've heard nothing about a wolf this far down. Okay, sure. I love getting pictures. If you can email them to me or something, that'd be great. Yeah.
My phone died.
So I think you had a question.
Is there any evidence that they've gotten to the islands and Cape Fear, where all the egrets?
Like Zeke's Island?
The Audubon Islands, where all the birds, there are thousands of birds nesting there every year.
Yeah, I think you're getting out of my district into District 4, so John Henry Harrelson.
Can they swim?
Yeah, they're avid swimmers. They can swim. You know, you bring up a good point, though. Ground nesting birds could certainly be a target for coyotes, but I don't know if I mentioned about
some benefits that are observed on the landscape when coyotes show up. So you can love coyotes or hate them, but regardless, you have to respect them. You know, when coyotes show up to an area, I think I did mention like feral cat population can, you know, decrease, essentially disappear, but it's estimated feral cats take in the tens of millions of songbirds a year. So if you love songbirds, that's an immediate benefit for songbirds. Other ground nesting birds like waterfowl, you know, a lot of times raccoons and possums and foxes can be avid nest robbers and, you know, chick robbers, and the coyotes might outcompete them, drive them away, or reduce their population. So, you know, those populations may benefit, and then, you know, as I mentioned from the public health standpoint, you know, reducing the rabies vector species on the landscape. So, you know, with coyotes on the landscape, there are some benefits to be seen, but if too many coyotes are on the landscape, then obviously you have a room full of people concerned. So it's all about that balancing act of finding where that homeostasis line is, like where people find that acceptable, I guess. So good question, though. Yes, ma'am.
I have a flashlight that does the strobe light.
Too. Oh, but that's it. Good, at parties, yeah.
Well, that. Because I like it to walk at 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Will that strobe light bother the coyotes?
It would bother me. I'm sure it would bother them. I think it would be erratic enough that it would be like.
Okay.
You know, it would freak them out.
A lot of noise when I'm out too, so that I'm not spazzing any.
That's a good idea, especially in bear country. They make a lot of noise. You know, I'm not going to tell you if that strobe is going to keep coyotes away from you or not. I mean, you know, some animals might be interested. What is that? And want to investigate. Some animals might be freaked out because they associate that with humans. So I don't know.
I like this area.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's a I'm glad to hear that songbirds might rejuvenate.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. Keep in mind when you're feeding those songbirds and things too, if you don't clean under your feeders and stuff, that's also your interest to coyotes and foxes and things. That's just keeping in mind the food chain. You may be feeding one animal, but it works its way. It's like giving, you know, one dog a treat and having the other one stare at you. Like, well, it's not your turn, Toby. They're not going to, you know, everything's going to get it while it's good.
And if you have friends in Onslow County North, encourage them to take their bird feeders down around April 1st. You know, bears come out and they're hungry and they go right for bird feeders. Get a lot of calls of shepherd's hooks bent over, bird feeders crushed, and things by hungry black bears. So around April 1st, good idea to stop feeding the birds further north of here. Yes, ma'am.
Will coyotes predate foxes for food?
I'm not going to say yes or no, but they are in direct competition for resources. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I would think a coyote would certainly, especially if a fox came into a den site area where there's young, yeah, they might be inclined to kill the fox because they view it as direct competition.
But for food, that's what I would
For food?
Potentially. I mean, they're omnivores.
It's usually a territorial thing. Yeah. They're both canids, and as Chris mentioned earlier, a canid, the fox, coyote, they don't like another canid in their area. So they will oftentimes have interactions with foxes. They actually can extirpate or basically eliminate red foxes from an area. Red foxes, they have a hard time running, getting away from coyotes. Gray foxes can actually climb trees. A lot of people don't realize that, so they have a harder time getting a handle on gray foxes, but in some habitats, they can also depress gray foxes quite a bit.
Because they normally wouldn't.
It's not usually
go for them as a food source.
It's not usually for food. It's usually because it's another canid in their territory, they're competing with it, and there's potential for them to harm their pups.
And as you said, distemper has really reduced the fox population anyway.
Gray fox. Gray fox is what is most by the stipper and raccoons.
Short one. Are there any rabbits on the Pleasure Island?
Very few.
I never saw one.
They're teeming with them.
Marsh rabbits, maybe?
Marsh rabbits.
Yeah, we don't see many of the hawks.
They would be food.
Do you have a lot of hawks and things that you've noticed? Lots of big birds of prey? They eliminate, they do a pretty good job on them as well.
Let's see. Get back to you. I'm going to call him first and then come back to you. Yes, sir. In the
most of that green space on the island is Moss's property.
Is what?
Sunny Point property.
Okay.
Protected. Usually your population.
Mm-hmm.
What is
the impact on the deer population. I know they go after fawns mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have this area, essentially half the island, what's the maximum density of coyotes if their food source is pretty much unlimited?
You know, I don't know how to answer that question as far as what capacity the landmass can support. It is tied directly to food source, though, and an overabundance of food source or unlimited amount, you know, they're going to have less competition, smaller home ranges. They don't have to search as far for their food. But specific to your question about deer populations, definitely, you know, coyotes are predators. They not only can predate on fawns, but, you know, adult coyotes can take down a full-grown deer occasionally. We've known that has happened. So, you know, deer will eventually adjust to coyotes. It's a new thing now, but they'll eventually adjust to it. From a deer hunter standpoint, a lot of deer hunters are upset about the presence of coyotes because they think the deer population is going to, you know, drop off as a result of that. And so, you know, we kind of coach them, you know, as far as how we hunt deer, if there's any deer hunters in here, can benefit the deer, like by harvesting does early in the season before the main breeding occurs, reducing the number of does on the landscape so the remaining does get bred within a smaller window of time. So therefore in the spring the fawns get dropped within a smaller window of time. So essentially the idea is to kind of flood the landscape with fawns in a small window, and it makes it tougher for coyotes, black bears, bobcats, other predators to systematically pick those fawns off. So, you know, in theory, by hunting like that, you have the chance of increasing fawn survival rates in the springtime versus waiting until the very last week or two of the season to harvest a doe to put meat in the freezer because she's already bred at that point. And, you know, anyway, that, I don't know if that answers your question or if I...
Well, we have more than enough deer here.
Right. Well, yeah, I did sense that from you. You know, so to follow up, I do have some really good information on deer-resistant plants. If there's any gardeners in the room that, you know, love lilies and things and plant them the next day, there aren't lilies. My wife included in that. So I've got really good information on deer-resistant plants. If you want to, you know, contact me by email, I send that to you in an attachment, and maybe it'll save you a little bit of money so you invest in plants that deer tend to not favor. There are community hunting programs as well. Our CDMAP program, Community Deer Management, that communities can kind of use as a deer management tool in their area. Emerald Isle and other small coastal towns have had, you know, major deer issues where they've seen numbers of complaints increase, number of vehicle collisions on the island increase, and by implementing one of those deer management type programs, they were able to, you know, reduce the number of vehicle collisions and number of complaints. And kind of if an animal population has no predator or no form of checks and balances, the food source is the only limiting thing on that animal population. So often humans need to step in as the management tool in that respect. I promised him I would come back to him. Yes, sir.
Just a question of interest. Have they been known to dig turtle nests?
Coyotes?
Yeah.
I would not be surprised. I don't have any documentation on how many turtle nests were, you know, predated by coyotes. I know raccoons are big turtle nest robbers, and to some extent foxes and even dogs. A lot of evidence showing, you know, domestic dogs getting off the leash or getting out and digging up turtle nests. Specific to coyotes, I don't know how many turtle nests, you know, have been destroyed each year by coyotes, but food source is a food source, you know, so it's certainly possible that could happen.
Okay.
Yep. Let's see. Yes, ma'am. I'll come back to you in a second. Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions. One, you mentioned property damage. What type of property damage are you referencing?
Well, yeah, I mean,
examples.
Yeah, some examples of property damage with coyotes. I mean, I guess in your garden, you know, chewing on things to get at a food source, going through a screened-in porch to get a cat or food that was left on the porch. I mean, I say that as just a general, you know, property damage. They're not the ones that we typically see that damage property versus black bears and raccoons and other animals that might get bold and want to, you know, try to get into your porch or your garage or something, but threatening of your pet, or if your pet got attacked, I mean, viewing that as property damage as well.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to address something Dennis brought up.
Motsa, representative from Motsa, was here this evening. He had to leave. He lived in Southport. He had to catch the 7 o'clock ferry home, so we can't wait for that.
Okay.
We're in the land use plan right now with Motsa, and we have brought up the burgeoning deer population and the coyotes. We're dealing with the federal government. This gets to an issue where we have to do something about these populations. They're going to be the big player in allowing us, as long as it's allowed, what we can do. We've already started the process if we have to get to where we trap or something. They're aware of it. And that's what we did ask them to be.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. And, you know, I feel it justified to mention Emerald Isle to y'all because they, you know, they are kind of maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ahead of y'all right now as far as coyotes showing up on the island, you know, numbers of residential complaints increasing, a pet or two maybe getting confronted or bitten, something like that. And so I think it's, you know, it's a testament to what a community can do. The police chief at the time, he researched coyotes, and he really had a whole folder on coyotes and coyote biology before he even reached out to my agency. And Evan went over and met with him essentially, and you know, and he had already done his research. But as far as finding out what options were available to them, where they are now, you know, 4 or 5 years later. You know, they, let's see, last year I think was the first year that they actually last year meaning 2017, they implemented a trapping program where they brought a trapper in. It's kind of run through the police department. One trapper wasn't charging them anything and was trapping on town property only, parks around boat ramps, natural areas, things like that. And I think the first year probably removed maybe 15 coyotes. 20 to 40, 45 pounds is your average size of coyote. They did catch one that was around 63, 64 pounds. That was a very large coyote and very unusual to be that large. But and then I think year two, roughly about the same, 12 coyotes. But you know, they're dealing with deer issues, deer complaints, vehicle collisions, and you know. But since they implemented that program in combination with an individual. Landowners in the town had an issue on their property with coyotes. You know, there was nothing stopping that landowner from hiring a damage control agent or a trapper to come in and trap on their property as well. The police department just required that they be registered through the police department and had to let the police department know when traps were being deployed, things like that. In the event that a dog were to get caught in one of the traps, they knew where every trap was at all times and when it was occurring. But I think year two, they probably removed about 12 or 13 coyotes as well. And so the number of complaints and issues that town has been dealing with has significantly dropped off. Now, are they done? Can they walk away from that? Probably not, because of coyotes around the area as they have pups and the pups disperse. Probably more coyotes will show up. So it may be like regular maintenance that they'll have to do to keep their coyote populations at a socially acceptable level. But you know, if you're interested in learning more about that, I'm sure you could contact that police chief and ask, you know, for information about what they're doing. There's more than one option out there. That's just one way of looking at it. Yes, ma'am.
I have another question. As far as I was walking my dogs in the evening, and on the corner there was a spotlight, or I guess a, you know, the light that lights the street, city light. But as I was walking, fairly close to me, a coyote was staring at us, and I thought, well, what do I do here? So I thought, I'm not going to run. That'd probably be the worst thing for me. I just started. I was fairly close to home, which was good, but neighbors. We're tucked in on a Sunday night, obviously, and asleep. We're going to get ready for work for the next morning. But I just started kind of running and making as much noise as possible towards the coyote. I thought, well, sure. I hope this works.
Preemptive strike.
And it did, but he didn't immediately run either. He kind of looked at me and lowered his head and put his head back up, and then he kind of, you know, popped into a lot. They cleared the lot now, but I didn't know what, if I run into that. I've stopped walking the dogs at night. I walk them during the day now.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what I kind of need to do. I know you mentioned noisemakers, but
take a whistle with you.
A whistle?
Yeah. I'll whistle. you know, what you did, you know, running at it, making noise.
I did.
If you have a small dog, I would encourage you to pick your small dog up so it's, you know, not down there and look as big as possible, make a lot of noise. Like I said, don't pull out your cell phone and take a picture. You want that animal to think, whoa, is this not a safe place for me to be? And, you know, hopefully we can spread the word about feeding these animals intentionally, how that's a bad idea. We don't want these animals to become habituated and to get more and more comfortable around people. We want them to maintain that healthy respect for humans. And, you know, those trapping programs and, you know, things like that actually do keep that fear instilled in these animals. And in the long run, it benefits them because it makes them stay away from people. And that's the idea behind. So walking at night, I mean, if you're seeing coyotes regularly in your area, you know, you walk earlier, you know, carry noisemakers, loud whistles, you know, like Becky mentioned, you know, carrying a stick just in case. I mean, you know, it's better to be safe than sorry. But I think what you did, yeah, it seemed to work.
Do they have, like, soft points on the body that you should aim for if they did decide they wanted to come after?
I would just avoid the mouth. So if you're doing a bluff strike and you're pumping yourself up, making yourself look as big and terrible, making some noise, and you get within, you know, a foot or two of them and they're not backing down, I mean, that might be one that's ill or one that's just like, yeah, whatever, Judy feeds me, I don't care, you know. And at that point, it'd probably be the same points for you, something around the neck. But if you want to make sure that if you do have a stick or something, that those that teeth are on the stick and not your arm or something like that. You want to make sure that he's focused on that. And maybe after a little while, he's like, well, this is too much trouble. You know, hopefully you won't get close enough where that's going to be something you need, because that would be something I don't think I would pursue, just because you don't know.
If you're close to home or somebody you know, if you got your phone, call them and have them come out if you can. You got time for that. And then usually in that scenario, the dog or the coyote is focused on the dog. And sometimes the coyote will totally ignore the person and will maintain focus on the dog. So you got to do everything you can to shift that focus. And if your dog is small enough, you know, one of the best things you can do is to pick, like Chris said, is pick that dog up.
Yeah, I have two. And they're not, one I can pick up, you know, she's about 40 pounds, the other one's.
But changing to walking in the daytime greatly reduces the chances of that kind of encounter.
Okay.
It's important to point out, like, you know, the number of people that have been bitten or attacked by coyotes in our state is so small, maybe three. I think all of them pretty much turned out to be disease type issues. It's not a common occurrence, you know. So, but as Evan mentioned, yeah, almost 100% of the time it's fixated on the dog. It's another canine. It's a competition. You know, it's competing for resources. That's how they view it. Not looking at you like she looks pretty tasty. It's that dog. You know, it's you know, potentially a threat to my young. It's a threat to my resources. That's how they're evaluating that confrontation there. So as he mentioned, making noise, stomping, you know, trying to get the pets up, diverting the coyote's attention elsewhere. Yeah.
And we're about to have longer days too. So you're gonna be on the same playing field visibility wise. So hopefully they won't take those chances as much.
Yep.
Yeah. And you can see it before to avoid them. Change hats. Maybe not somewhere that's a little woody outside.
Can you put that slide back up with the contact information and stuff? I didn't know how to get out of that right there. Yes, ma'am, in the green.
One of the problems that we have in Curie Beach right now, please wait a minute, is the fact that somebody went on the internet and put all this stuff on how horribly dangerous and vicious all the coyotes were. And everybody's children now are in harm's way. Don't realize we've been here for a while, and it's not something new for this summer. And it's not a thing where we have to have somebody come in and eradicate them because three people have seen them.
Right.
I mean, that's ridiculous. But the problem is that if the threat of hysteria is out there, and it's not necessary. And that's one of the things that people of our little island need to realize. We've had bears here. We've had bobcats. We've had coyotes. We've had a lot of animals. We've got poisonous snakes. They don't bother you if you don't go where they are. If you give them respect in nature to stay where they are, they don't bother you. And you have to realize that it's their island too. And it's been there as long as it was ours.
And unfortunately, fear mongering is something that it's contagious. Makes people put the channel and put the TV station on. So it's something we get caught up, like you said. But that's where education really helps. I mean, all of you have obviously come here because you have an interest and you want to know what's going on. But even for the tourists or other people that start saying that, if you hear misinformation being spread and you feel comfortable with correcting that or gently, you know, just saying, hey, you know, actually, I heard that that's not true and this and this. And if you want more information, you can go to this website or whatever. Or people don't really get picked up by coyotes. There's not five waiting in the backyard to take you out.
That's the concept that was put out over the internet. Is it your children in your backyard are going to be carted off?
Well, that's why everything on the internet is true, right?
And somebody out in the backyard is already gone. No bother looking for it.
Right.
And this is the wrong concept to get out to people. And it's, we have to stop that. Yeah, because otherwise people come here are going to go,
it starts with a local thing. So when you do hear that misinformation, you can kind of stomp that out politely. Another thing, though, to take into consideration is, I know we have a lot of people that have lived here for, I've heard some people say 20, 30 years, but we have a lot of people that also moved down here for retirement. And so they're not used to walking out on their deck and say, I don't know, Ohio, and be like, well, there's an alligator right there. That needs to be taken away. This is a sense of place. This is mine. And so, you know, it's almost like you have to be retrained in terms of your ecosystem, your natural history in those areas. And as we start to see that population shift, it's really important to make sure that we have, you know, good sources of information that are consistent, that are constantly put out there, reliable news and things like that. I've also seen some things on the news about coyotes before in Wilmington, terrorizing Wilmington. It's like, no, they're not. They're moving through. And so I guess another thing, too, now that you've been here tonight, hopefully you have that kind of other lens that you can kind of filter some of that stuff out. And if you do see things that are misrepresented, you have a potential to just give feedback, you know, talk to the editor or whoever else, not just the news, but just people in general. If you see something from a source that's supposed to be reputable, maybe in the town or the community, and you have questions about it, don't hesitate to kind of say, hey, I challenge that a little bit.
I have one other suggestion. They just said that the greenway, the bicycles, and the people who walk. Do the same thing as people hiking in the mountains do with bears. Carry a bell. Little things like that.
I'm more worried about the two-legged predators and people that are out and around. So it's always just about being aware of situational awareness in all cases on that. But also, when you do open greenways and things like that, you're going to start to see a lot more pollution and debris and things like that that are spewed around. And so that's another issue, because then you're creating potential for food sources. And then, I mean, the tourists, they come down here for the views, but they also, they imbibe a little. And so that also will increase, you know, the negative interactions that we have with wildlife, because people, they don't make any judgment calls. So, I mean, that's another thing with the end of the community. If you feel like you're comfortable telling people, you know, the correct things and things that are happening, but also having a sense of pride about, hey, look, we don't want all this trash laying around. We don't want all this, and try to start that from this level and work our way up. It'll find more support, and it'll be longer lasting solution. But just, we got to eliminate those food sources is a big part of it. As Chris was saying, that's kind of the vice grip that they have on us right now, and it's not hospitable for them. They're going to move on. You're still going to have some that are around them. But yeah, the hysteria is an issue, but it's also something that if you don't know, if you're not comfortable, you're going to drive that up. So even if you know certain pockets of people or populations or areas that do have that kind of feeling, let me know. I've got my card up here. That's where I need to be. I need to be there teaching them to talk to them about things and actually taking them out and showing them different things in the habitat and maybe making site visits where necessary, because that's important.
Somebody had mentioned the deer and the coyotes in the same area. We've been out here in the evenings and seen five or six coyotes out here and a herd of nine deer in the same field. Now, they're not intermingling, but they're in the same field. If there's not a reason, they're not out to take an animal because it sees an animal. You know, a wild animal takes another animal because they're hungry.
part of it is we are kind of, not everybody, but a little bit more farther removed. We're not as the predator-prey reaction doesn't affect us quite as, you know, as harsh as it does, say, a coyote. But then also, everybody wants to put coyotes and wolves in the same boat a lot of times with habitat and behavior and stuff, and it's just not the same. But again, that's just, hopefully we can encourage people to partake in the outdoors and do more activities in nature where instead of seeing a coyote and be like, oh gosh, or an alligator or something, it's not like end all be all. It's something that's like, okay, I'm in this habitat. This is what I expect to see when I come here. I'm going to be more observant where I am and hopefully enjoy it instead of just trying to raise a fuss or get it moved or get it taken out. But obviously if there's an issue, we want to report it. And that's kind of our first line of public health reporting as well is you. If you notice strange animal behavior or something, you live here for 20 years and you've always seen this, this, and this, and this year something's off. I mean, that helps us a lot too because it's a lot of extra information as everything is changing.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we can maybe wrap this up in about 10 minutes, I want to make sure that these fine people who have a 2.5-hour drive this evening have an opportunity to get home. So if there's anything else that...
Thank you very much. This was excellent.
All right. Glad you enjoyed it.
Yes, ma'am.
I only have a few lists. I didn't put them out.
Make sure everybody... Oh.